just read this article. This man was trying to convince me that the three most powerful words in the English language are "I love you." Look, me to you guys, seriously, those are great words. I don't even think they're close to the three most powerful. I think the three most powerful words in the English language are "I don't know." Those are big words.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, skeptical comedy, ignorant and nonsensical hecklers, and conservatives just aren't that funny. All coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
And I'm Peggy Knutson.
How you doing, Peggy?
I am doing great today, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's up?
Today is baking day.
Nice.
I've been baking since early this morning and getting ready for the holidays. How about you? What kind of traditions do you have for the holiday?
Well, we have this one tradition that we started probably about 10 years ago. My wife has one of those houses where you put little gifts and candies in for each day up to 25 days in December. Do you know it was on Christmas vacation, something similar to it?
Right.
So we thought it would be a good idea and that it'd be kind of cute. But it turns out it's a really big commitment putting something in there every day. And it turns out also that if you skip a day or if you forget to put something in it, your kids get really pissed off. And it kind of defeats the whole purpose of the fun little tradition. So I don't think we're going to be doing that anymore.
Do you have to come up with something different for every day?
You don't have to.
You could just do the same thing every day.
Sometimes we get lazy and we just throw like one M&M in each of the 25 doors. Here you go, kids. Merry freaking Christmas.
A different colored gumdrop.
Right. Well, this is going to be a fun interview. We're speaking with Stuart Huff. And we talk about how we met him in the interview, so I won't give too much away here. So let's just bring him on. And Peggy and I are speaking with Stuart Huff. How are you, Stuart?
I am great. How are you guys today?
Excellent.
Doing well, thanks.
I'm really glad you guys invited me on. To be honest, like morning radio, I do a lot of morning radio. It is the worst part of my job. But this type of interview is a pleasure, you know, where you can actually talk about things that matter, you know, and things that are interesting. And morning radio just wants to hear sex jokes and then give away some tickets and then do a Hardee's commercial.
Right. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. So, Stuart, what's your favorite sex joke? So on these morning zoo shows, are these crazy, zany shows that you have to always be on like 100% all the time?
Yeah, that's what they are. And that's all they want. So even if you say, hey, let's do a couple of stupid jokes, but then I want to talk about something important. No, we do not want to hear anything with substance. I've actually had people say that directly to me. Don't do anything with substance.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to? Is the listening audience, is that the factor?
I think my own personal guess is that they are, number one, underestimating their audience. I think the
intelligence of their audience.
Yes. I think they have funneled it down to what they think is a perfect formula. And I don't agree with them. You know, I've met people that listen to those stations and they're not that dumb.
Yeah. I would say too, many of these stations probably want to stay away from controversial material, such as some of the stuff that you talk about, especially down south. Do you think that might be part of it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
They're much more concerned about one person complaining than they are about interesting material, you know? So I find it in comedy clubs, too. If I have an audience of 200 people and I offend a group of three of them and everybody else had a good time, then I will sometimes not be asked back to the club because three people were offended.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Stuart, Bo and I were able to see your performance at the Florida Humanist Association conference, and it was amazing. You had incredibly interesting material, and a lot of it had to do with skepticism. I wanted to know how you research some of the information for your jokes.
Yeah, you seemed very well informed. You're not just out there throwing out stuff that people find on the internet. You're not reciting memes. You're well informed. Right. So congratulations with that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't. This was not intentional. But what has happened over my career is slowly it's evolved to this point where I have an idea. And I want to know if I'm right. I'm not even thinking, is this funny? I'm thinking, you know, here's a good example. I met a guy on a plane who was just furious about global warming. And of course, he didn't believe it. And he was so mad at science and literally made some very ridiculous things, said some ridiculous things about how stupid science is.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, which was cracking me up. He wasn't mad at a particular scientist. He was mad at science. And
science itself, right. That makes sense.
He's on a plane.
Right. That's yeah, exactly.
He's and flying.
I was finding it really hard to not just bust out laughing. So I started to think, I wonder when this started. I wonder when this anger towards science started. So then I researched and I read, you know, multiple websites and a couple of books and because it fascinated to me and it still does. What is it about human beings, some of us, that, you know, get angry about this? And that's so I end up talking a lot about that in my show that I'm doing right now. So it starts with me being interested and then me informing myself and trying to learn about it. But if I'm interested in something, it's going to come out on stage, you know, and then the goal becomes, how do I make it funny?
Yeah.
So a chance meeting led to some really amazing material.
Yeah. I mean, and it might be something that someone says to me, something I see. You know, something I just think about and wonder, you know, and then I end up we live in this time when we actually have access to material. We can learn anything we want to learn, you know. You don't have to go back that far in history to where that's not the case. So I'm still that way where I just go, oh, wow, I wonder when terrorism started, you know. I wonder what the first case is. I wonder when that word was used. And then I end up researching this stuff and learning something about it. And then most of the time it ends up coming out on stage.
Right. You know? Well, you know, terrorism started when Obama took office. Thanks, Obama.
Right.
I thought it was Cain and Abel.
Yeah, I just was researching it a little bit last night. Apparently the word was first used during the French Revolution, but the actual action, you know, the literal definition was like 1 BC, something like that. So it's a long time.
Wow.
Right. I just looked that up too, and I found that terrorism has to be associated with some kind of political goal to be classified as terrorism, at least according to one definition. Did you find the same?
I did. I found that interesting too, but yeah, and that's, that seems to be, I read 5 or 6 different definitions, and that seems to be the constant through all of them, is there's a political goal involved.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're just completely psycho, and you're just going into a crowd and blowing people up or shooting people, then that's really not terrorism. It's just you're psycho.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, well, I haven't learned a lot about it yet, but yeah, I found that interesting too, Bo. It's like that that motive has to be there, apparently, to be labeled terrorism.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit, Stuart. Actually, let's go back a lot, depending on when you actually became an atheist. Were you always an atheist, or was this something that is a recent development, or what's your story?
I classify myself more as an agnostic, but atheist is fine. I don't have a problem with that at all. No, I was not born and raised in a very religious household. My parents, this sounds like a joke, but it's true. They will tell you they're Baptist if you ask, but the only time we ever went to church was Christmas and when I did something really bad. So I remember clearly being a teenager, and there would be like we would be at a family reunion or something like that, and I remember hearing my parents several times say, "We're Baptist," and I would think to myself, "Are we? I did not know we were Baptist. The last church we went to was Methodist." It was always, whenever we would move somewhere, it was always what church is the closest. So I don't consider myself raised in a religious household, but it was definitely, we prayed on Thanksgiving, you know, that was about it. And but if you ask them, they'll tell you they are. And they got mad. My parents are not happy, and they do not want to discuss the fact that I don't believe, you know, and it, which is kind of interesting to me and sad, but that's the way they are. They don't want to face it. They don't want to talk about it.
Well, cultural Christianity is very powerful.
Yeah.
Even if you're not highly involved, most people still consider themselves cultural Christians, and it is, it's part of their identity.
Yeah. And I think that's a big part of both of them. And somewhere in my 20s, I just really thought about it. It's probably the first time I'd ever really thought about it. Just thought nobody knows. So how can I say that I'm a believer, I believe in this, when I don't know any, I don't know, you know? So, and then by the time I was in my 30s, I got to the point where it was just, I would highly doubt that there's, you know, that we're that we know anything about it, and I don't believe in any of it. And that's pretty much the point I'm at now, you know. I think actually fascinated by religions. I studied them a little bit in college. I think it's kind of sick and beautiful at the same time that human beings made up these answers, and they're very intricate and, you know, contradicting, and some of them are crazy and insane, and, you know, it's interesting that we made up this answer to a curious question that nobody still knows, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what religion is good at, making up crap.
Yeah. Making up, you know, and some people take it so seriously they're willing to kill for it. You know, it's ludicrous. It's very dangerous. I don't like it. But on a wide angle view, you know, it's interesting that human beings need answers. We have to make something up, you know. I'm working on a thing right now on stage about how if you answer a question when you do not have the facts, it's called a guess, you know. And that's the way I look at religions. It's nothing more than a guess.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with Stuart Huff.
Fear. A lot of our behavior is driven by fear. A preacher in Texas recently said that global warming is God's revenge for abortion. I know there's a couple of people in this room that are thinking the same thing I thought when I read that. A preacher in Texas believes in global warming. We are winning! We're winning the battle. We're tossing pebbles into the ocean, and they're starting to stack up. Isn't that the dumbest sentence you've ever heard? Global warming is God's revenge for abortion. Like God's up there going, "I don't like him killing babies. I'm going to make it real hot."
How did your routine evolve? Did it always start as kind of like a skeptical, agnostic routine, or did it evolve into that from something else?
No, at the beginning, I mean, there is, I'm sure you guys can imagine, when you walk up on stage, just you underneath a light with a microphone in front of an audience, the pressure to succeed is overwhelming. So at the beginning, all I was trying to do was be funny. And so I would write jokes that I thought would make the crowd laugh. And I would go up there and tell them and hope really, fingers crossed, you know, all the superstition with me, please hope that I would make them laugh. And then after I kind of got comfortable being on stage and got a little bit comfortable that I could make an audience laugh, then I began to want to actually say something that mattered to me, that something I was interested in. And that's when it started to get really difficult. That's when audiences, the majority of regular comedy club going audiences, they do not want to hear your opinions and your thoughts unless it's 100% what they believe.
Hmm.
You know?
So you start out with just the goal of making people laugh as you begin your career. Does that goal change as you have been in comedy for over 15 years now? Do you have any, do your career goals change? What's the ultimate goal for a comedian?
Well, yeah, my goals have totally changed. almost become the direct opposite. I think when I got into comedy, I was just curious about it. I was a fan of Carlin, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce. I'm a philosophy nerd, and I like listen to those guys, and I just wanted to see if I could do it. And then once you do it enough and you get a little bit comfortable with it, then your goals kind of go, well, maybe I could get on TV, maybe I could do this. The little bit of experience I've had with the Hollywood side of this art form, I've hated. I hated every aspect of it. So then now my goals are to simply express myself and hopefully be able to translate it to an audience to where they laugh. You know, I have zero interest in getting on television or having a show or being in movies or any of that stuff. Right now, my entire goal is to figure out how to make this hour that I'm writing work on stage, you know, and then I'll record it on a CD and then start working on another hour. So that challenge is actually the most rewarding thing that I've ever encountered, you know?
It's got to be very difficult because you travel most of the year. You're on the road 47, 48 weeks out of the year, and that's got to be incredibly challenging.
There are definitely parts of it that are really challenging, but oddly enough, the more I do it, the more I like it. It's very strange. There's something about, well, I'll put it this way. When I'm at home, there have been several times that I wake up and I don't know where I'm at. I feel strange.
Oh, that happens to all of us.
Yeah.
For different reasons.
Yeah. The layout of a hotel room, I seem to just know. I can wake up in the dark and go to the bathroom and, but at home I kind of have to think about things. If I don't drive, if I go several weeks without driving, I feel weird. I feel withdrawal symptoms. It's very strange.
Wow.
Being on the road traveling is really pleasurable to me. I enjoy, even if I meet horrible hate-filled people that are screaming and yelling at me, I don't like that, but I'd rather meet them than be in my own bubble.
Yeah. It's about the people.
It's about the people. It's about the places. It's about, I feel like I'm actually learning about, other people, my race, my whatever. That's not the right word. But, you know, I feel like I'm getting out there and when I grew up, I was in the South and I had an opinion that once I get out of the South, I will be surrounded by intelligent, well-read people. Because I always thought that the South is the dumb place, you know? And then I've been in all 50 states. There's dumb people everywhere.
Surprise!
Right. Yeah. It's not a regional issue. It's a human disease.
Yeah, it's the human race you're talking about.
The human race. Yeah. So that was a huge learning curve for me. I was in Albuquerque looking at people do the dumbest things I've ever seen. I'm like, this is Albuquerque. This isn't Alabama.
Hmm.
You know? And then I go to Canada and I go to Mexico and then I learn that we're pretty much the same everywhere. And then, you know, to me, I would hate to not know that.
Yeah. Are there any, like, really big name conservative comics or comedians out there?
Let me think about it 1 second. I think Dennis Miller is now completely conservative.
Really?
Yeah. I don't listen to him, so don't hold me to that. But I know he went from being left to definitely skewing right.
Wow.
Last couple of things I've heard from him are just, I'm kind of shocked. I find myself thinking, wait a minute, you know, you've completely turned around. That's interesting. You know, politically, he's the pendulum.
Right. I would guess that Jeff Foxworthy is probably conservative, but he doesn't bring that out in his comedy, at least not that I know of.
Yeah, I think the thing is, a lot of comics would never tell you on stage because they're afraid of losing laughter. Hmm. They're afraid of losing fans. I've never met Jeff Foxworthy, but I know a lot of people who know him. And yeah, I would say he's definitely, extremely Christian. He took over. They put his name on a Sirius radio station that used to play me quite a bit, but now that his name is on there, strangely enough, I've been dropped.
Huh.
Yeah. And I talked to another guy. I don't know this for a fact, but another comic who is kind of very openly left on stage and has a couple of bits questioning religion, and he was dropped too, you know. So it makes you wonder how much involvement he had in that. But, you know, a lot of comedians are, I would label them conservative, but you would never know it by watching them on stage.
Hmm. So if they are conservative, they kind of keep those opinions on the down low.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So because either way, I mean, you're better off not saying anything on stage. You know, if your goal is laughter and success, you're better off keeping your mouth shut.
Well, you got to say something.
Excuse me?
You got to say something on stage. You can't just go up there and be quiet, right?
Well, yeah, but what I mean by say something is like, you just do sex jokes and drinking jokes and
there you
relationship
go.
Jokes and, you know, don't say anything from your heart.
Yeah, the low-hanging fruit. But I've noticed, I've been a big fan of comedy pretty much all my life, and the stand-up comedians, like the real good ones, are the ones that do kind of walk that line, who take those risks. And guaranteed there's a segment of the population who just can't stand these comedians, but I think their fan base is so strong and so loyal that it makes up for it. What's that guy? Louis C.K. is one mm-hmm. I think of top of my head. You know, some of the stuff that he says, it's like, holy crap, I can't believe he gets away with saying that. But,
right,
but it's funny.
Yeah, and he's great.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that's kind of the key is if you can get enough people that really love what you do, not like, but love what you do, people that are willing to get in their car and drive to see you, you get enough of those people, then you're not risking anything. You say whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, Peggy, you had a really good question for Stuart.
Oh, yes, I do. And Stuart, let's see if you'll answer this for me or not. So you have a couple of favorites. Carlin was an inspiration. I think you said Lenny Bruce. Mm-hmm. Who is overrated in your opinion? Do you have any comedians that you don't like?
Oh, yeah. I've got
that you'll admit to.
There's a lot of comics I don't like. But you know, let me say this first, okay? Okay, let me say this first.
You're qualifying.
I think you guys will agree with this, okay? There is a when you're in an art form, especially when you're trying to learn that art form, you're frustrated because it's a hard thing to learn. So there is an impetus to hate, you know, anybody that is succeeding. You have a chip on your shoulder. Mm-hmm. But I learned pretty quick that type of mentality, it's very negative to me. I'm not a happy person when I think that way. So I made a conscious effort. I don't want to sit around and talk about how much I hate so-and-so. I want to talk about how much I love this person or that person. Or, you know, I seem to be more creative, more, you know, I produce better comedy when I'm thinking and talking about people I really like, you know. But so what I do now is I will, if I'm working with other comics, and I'll sit there and watch them. But if I hate them, I'll get up and leave the room. I do not want to sit there and hate somebody. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be thinking about something that makes me happy. And especially if I'm going up after this person and I hate them and the crowd loves them, then I automatically don't like this crowd. You know, they like this person.
So, right.
You know?
Right.
Well, there's probably a difference in, you could have a comedian who you may not be fond of as a person, but their comedy is good. But the opposite could be true as well. You love them as a person, but their comedy is not your taste.
Yeah, I'm wondering what the source of the hate is. Is it the material, or is it the sentiment behind the material? Like just not being funny, or just being mean, or you disagree with it?
Oh, there's probably a little of both. There are some comedians that I personally do not like on stage, but I'm friends with them off stage. And the reason I don't like them on stage is because I don't think that they're trying. I seem to have an issue when I know someone, and off stage, they're very curious, smart people, but on stage, they're, like you said, low hanging fruit. They're just taking the easiest way out. I don't like that. I wish they would try harder. And then there are people that I think are truly great on stage, and I've met them off stage, and I don't want to spend another second of my life with them, you know? And that usually has a lot to do with ego. I'm not a fan of ego. And every famous comedian that I've met that I think is amazing is humble, which I find very interesting, you know. I have personally yet to meet an arrogant person, a famous person, who is also really good on stage, you know.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I Colin Quinn, I think, is one of the best comics working right now. And he's super nice to me, extremely nice, and still excited about being a comedian, excited on working with material, you know, working on material. But to answer your question, are there comics I think are overrated? That's a difficult question, because you have to be honest and sound like a jerk, but I personally think probably half of the comedians that are famous are overrated. Wow. Jeff Foxworthy's overrated. But he's so huge. I mean, my God, those guys, the blue collar comics, I mean, they're enormously famous. You would have to be genius level to not be overrated, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for, you know, if he was in a club, I haven't seen a whole lot of what he does, but I've never been impressed with him. It's just not my cup of tea, you know.
And that group is Larry the Cable Guy, mm-hmm. and I can't remember who else.
Ron White
and
Bill Engvall.
Bill,
you know what? I feel confident in saying this, and it is a kind of a mean statement, but I'll go ahead and say Bill Engvall is the most overrated comedian alive today.
Yeah. Okay.
I think he's the most overrated. Every single time I've seen him on stage, I think to myself, you're not even club funny. How you get to this, you know, he's a multimillionaire, and I don't, you know, I mean, there are people that are going to be opening for me this week that are funnier than he is.
Bill should be giving you half his money.
I think that'd be fair. Probably a product of people and timing. He's in the right place at the right time.
That's a huge part of this business. It's an enormous part of this business. Who do you know? Who do you know that owes you a favor? You know, where are you when somebody needs something done? You know, that kind of stuff I'm just not interested in. I'm much more interested in right now the show I'm working on, the show that you guys saw at the Humanist Convention. I'm trying to do an hour on belief systems and how dangerous they are, and how I think we formed belief systems before we got all the facts in. Whoops. You know?
Right.
And if I can make it work, then that's I'll be proud of myself. And that's a good goal to have. And, you know, it's very challenging to do stand-up comedy about belief systems in front of people that have two buckets of Bud Light on their table.
So what are your audience reactions when you're, let's say, down, and I don't want to pick on down south, but statistically, given your content, you're more likely to have negative reactions from the audience if you are performing at a club down south. So that I'll just stick with down south. So what are the audience reactions generally when you start talking about this stuff? Do they just kind of clam up and kind of like a nervous giggle? Do they laugh along with you just because they're too drunk to even tell the difference? Or do they get up and storm out of the club?
Or do they punch you in the nose?
Yeah, or they throw something at you?
I can tell. Let's tell some stories, because this is perfect. The Humanist Podcast, perfect time to tell some stories about this.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with Stuart Huff about his atheist comedy.
Do you guys feel like America is casually dating logic? We're definitely seeing her, but we ain't ready to commit. We're also casually dating Superstition, and she's a hell of a lot more fun than logic. Superstition is fun. Halloween's more fun than President's Day. Shit, St. Patrick's Day's more fun than President's Day. You know why we wear green on St. Patrick's Day? Our ancestors truly believed that green makes human beings invisible to leprechauns. That's fun as shit. We all put on green, drink some liquid wheat, get f***ed up. We have a good time. Nobody cares about President's Day. Nobody wants a f***ing mattress. There's no superstition involved in President's Day. None. So we don't even really celebrate it. Yeah, superstition is fun. It's batshit crazy and a f***ing liar, but at least she parties.
I would not disagree with you at all, Bo. Down south, I get a more angry reaction, but I've also gotten anger in, you know, Fargo, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. I was on stage and someone stood up and yelled, this is what they yelled, which I thought was great. They said, angrily said, you're a damn atheist. Is what he said. Like he had figured it out. And they were, yeah, like it was just some revelation. He'd figured this out and
that's
stood up
what you are.
And screamed it at me. And I said, okay, so that was my reaction to him. And then I said, what are you? And he said, I'm a goddamn Christian. And then I said, that's interesting. You rarely hear those two words back to back. Yeah. And then that, I think, confused him. So he kind of, there was a couple of seconds where he was confused, but then I think he figured out that he had made a mistake and I called him on it or whatever his brain said. And then the anger exploded and he started to come towards the stage.
Wow.
Yeah, but by that time, the manager of the club and one of the other comedians had grabbed him. And, you know, he was coming towards me. And they drug him out of the crowd, drug him out of the room, you know. I was in Calgary, Canada this past week. I just got back yesterday from Calgary. A guy in the audience started screaming. Can we cuss on this podcast, by the way?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I'm quoting other people, but he started screaming "fuck you" at me just over and over again, just repetitively. And so I, you know, I said, "Come up with something more interesting, or you're going to bore me to death, sir." You know, and he just kept doing it until he said, "I'm going to kick your ass." And I said, "Well, then stop talking and do it. You know, I like action, sir. Do something." And he started to come towards me, and an audience member stopped him. And then the bartender, and they removed him from the club and they locked the door. And then I found out he went to the hotel I'm at.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and he told the hotel front desk that he was my cousin, and he asked for my room number.
Oh. You know?
So then the hotel got involved, and it was a big mess. Yeah,
that's
and
surprising. It was Canada.
I know. It's so shocking to me that humans are so similar everywhere I've ever been. You know, Macon, Georgia. I was telling my sister, I have two sisters. One is a lesbian, and I donated sperm to her and her partner so they could have a baby. And I have a comedy bit about it. So, and it is my sister's wife who was pregnant.
Okay, she's the one who had the sperm. I was going to ask you about that just to clarify.
Right, yeah, I'm Kentucky, but I'm not that Kentucky.
Okay.
So I'm telling this story, and, you know, it's jokes, and it's, you know, about donating sperm to my sister's wife in Macon, Georgia. And I hear a guy yell, "Faggot." That's the way that's the way he said it, "Faggot." And I turned around, and he was on stage, and he punched me dead in the face.
That doesn't even make sense.
I know. I know.
You're telling a story of your sister, who's a lesbian, and he calls you a how do you say it again?
"Faggot."
All right, perfect. And then he punches you. Probably
me.
By association.
Just incredible, ignorant behavior from everywhere. You know, very few places where that I haven't experienced some sort of negativity. And when I get into the area of my beliefs religiously or lack of beliefs, then it really ratchets up. You know, I've had people, Duluth, Minnesota. I was doing a show to silence, about an hour on stage, and I don't think there was hardly any laughter at all. And I was doing material about why I don't, believe in religion and why I think it's horrible and more dangerous than good, ultimately. And I got an email from a guy who said that him and his wife and their neighbors loved every single thing that I said, and they agreed with me, but they were too scared to laugh.
Hmm.
You know?
Oh.
Yeah. Thanks. And I understood. I mean, the tension in that room was palpable. I didn't know if I was going to make it out of there or not. I mean, so I can imagine sitting there and being too scared to laugh. And that's what I believe. I had a show in Mississippi one time at a casino in Mississippi. And I actually said out loud to the bartender, I said, "Get the back door ready because I'm running as soon as I'm done with this show." Like, I really, I was that nervous, you know. And I got off stage, and he said to me, "Just go in that room over there." And I went in this room and closed the door. And people were asking him where I was. They wanted to kick my ass, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, jeez.
After everyone had left, I came out of that room, and there were two women sitting there, and they said, "Oh, I'm glad you finally came out." They said, "We wanted to say thank you for," I was doing a bit at the time about why I believe gay marriage should be legal. And they said, thank you for saying that. You never hear anybody say anything like that around here. And we just wanted to say thank you. So
that's got to be unbelievably rewarding that you're a voice for the voiceless.
Yeah. And I don't think about it that way until it happens. And when it does, I feel so good. Hmm. And so I've had people in Canada threaten me. I've been punched. Aiken, South Carolina, a guy beat me up pretty bad after the show. I had to get dental work done.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, he kicked me in the mouth. I was laying on the floor. He had punched me, and I was on the floor. He kicked me and broke a tooth. And I've also had people in South Carolina come up to me and say, thank you for talking negatively about the Confederate flag. It needs to be said more. You know, I truly believe that there are people full of love everywhere. They're everywhere. And there are people full of hate everywhere, you know. But they do seem to concentrate in the South. Yeah. I will agree with that.
Well, it seems like the majority of these people are probably being upset with your lack of belief or your... the way you talk about religions. Are these people familiar with the pacifism of Jesus? maybe you should work that into the routine. So before they start to feel the need to beat the crap out of you, they'll start reflecting on Jesus and his turning the other cheek.
Yeah, it's very funny to me when you read their bumper stickers or their signs they bought at Crackle Barrel, and then you actually look at their behavior.
Yeah, great. So do these club owners that book you, do they know about your material? Do they know what to expect? Do they know what they're getting into?
Very few of them. Hmm. I would say that here's what happens is, I get hired because, like Peggy said, I know somebody. I was in the right place at the right time. Somebody said something to somebody, that type of thing. I get hired. I go into a club. I do my act. The club owner is usually not even watching. They're usually counting money or counting beer or something. If the audience complains, then I will not be invited back. So I would have to say a lot of the clubs I go to, I'm not invited back to, you know. Sometimes a club owner will, and these are my favorite clubs, will say to me, you do exactly what you do. I love it. I've got your back.
That's awesome. And
yeah, there's about five or six clubs right off the top of my head, maybe more, maybe seven or eight that I can think of that, you know, they trust me. I'm not trying to offend their audience. Their audience just happens to be offended, you know? And I think that's a big difference. I don't set out to offend anybody. I set out to make my opinions and my thoughts funny. And if their audience can't handle it, then, you know, I'm not attacking them for their beliefs. I'm explaining my beliefs.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So there's seven or eight clubs that love it. But like Calgary, Canada is a good example just because I just came back from there. The owner was not happy at all. And I've worked there four times now. But this is the first time someone's stood up and threatened me, you know. So he's not happy.
Stuart, do you have any opinions on kind of what's going on college campuses of being – overly sensitive, especially to comedy and not wanting to be offended, and young people speaking out against what they think is offensive, especially for comedians?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story, and this is kind of what I think. University of Kentucky, which is the state I was born in, hired me to do 1 hour. I was contractually paid to do 1 hour of comedy. And I have a stopwatch that I wear on my wrist. So at minute 12, the guy that was in charge, the adult that was in charge, there was about 200 kids in the crowd. And I was talking about donating sperm to my sister's wife. I was talking about gay marriage. At the time, it was not legal. And he yelled at me from the audience. He said, stop offending people. That's what he said. And I said, I don't think I can.
That's perfect.
And then he said, perfect. Well, then get off stage. And I stood there for a second and I thought, no. And I said to him, no, I'm not going to get off stage. And I'll tell you the reason I said that. Because I think even if you disagree with what I'm saying, I'm not, it's worth listening to. Does that make sense?
It's a comedy routine.
I
mean, I think there are different standards if a lecturer is invited to the university to talk about some important social issue or a politician. But geez, you're a comedian. I think you should have a much longer rope when it comes to delivering your material.
That's what comedy is about.
Exactly. And people have to go into some kind of comedy routine expecting not to like a few of the jokes or to be offended by some of the jokes.
Yeah, I would think so. So at minute 18, I told this guy, he said, well, then get off stage. And I said, no, I'm not going to. And I kept going. And then at minute 18, he came up on stage and took the microphone out of my hand.
Wow.
So, yeah, they stopped me. And then his boss, there was a huge hubbub about it. They didn't want to pay me. I said to the guy, censored me. And he said, I'm allowed to censor you. We have a free speech area if you want to talk about your views. And I said, area? What are you talking about? They at the University of Kentucky, I don't know if this is common on all campuses or not, they have a 10-foot by 10-foot space where if you want to go and talk, you can stand in that space and say whatever you want. But you're not allowed to go outside of it, I guess. And, so I left there and just with no money, they didn't pay me. And I just left there. And there was a lot of back and forth with emails about whether or not they're going to pay me, blah, blah, blah. And it got down to the point where I said, look, I don't care if you pay me or not. I want you to understand that freedom of speech is not a 10 by 10 space area, So they eventually paid me because some students found out about it that weren't even there and started protesting about it, started up in arms about it. So my thing is, I think colleges of all places should be controversial. I think that opinions that I don't agree with should be brought up and discussed at colleges of all places.
All right, Stuart, we got to wrap this up. This has been wonderful. Why don't you let our listeners know where they can find out more information about you, where they can get your CD or whatever you have out there?
Yeah, stuarthuff.com is my website, STEWARTHUFF. My CDs are actually on the website. They're also on iTunes. iTunes is, of course, you download it. If you want the actual CD, because I'm still one of those weirdos who likes to hold things in my hand and look at the pictures and that kind of thing. So if you want the actual CD on my website, it goes through PayPal and I will mail it to you. And then I'm on Twitter, Stu Huff, STEWHUFF. And you can email me through my website too.
All right. Hey, Stuart, do you happen to have your material on 8-track by any chance?
I would love to. I actually have a working 8-track player.
Nice. And in the middle of one of your jokes, right before the punchline, it switches over to the next track,
With that beautiful sound.
Right. Yeah. Good stuff. All right, Stuart, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it. It was much more fun than the morning crew.
All right. It was great talking to you.
All right. And this is Bill and Peggy with the Morning Zoo. All right. Take care. All right, that was Stuart Huff, secular comedian and one funny guy. If you have any feedback for this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. And we'll leave you with some more comedy from Stuart. And if you stick around after the episode, there's a little bit more to the interview.
I just read this article. This man was trying to convince me that the three most powerful words in the English language are, I love you. Look, me to you guys, seriously, those are great words. I don't even think they're close to the three most powerful. I think the three most powerful words in the English language are, I don't know. Those are big words. Admitting you don't have answers opens you up to learn, to listen to somebody else who might. I think I don't know might just be the doorway to pure intelligence. Can I make a meatloaf? I don't know. Seven hours later, no, I can't make no fucking meatloaf. I just got a big damn burger, is all I got.
If you guys don't mind, can I tell another story real quick?
Absolutely, yeah. Go ahead.
South Bend, Indiana. I'm not going to give this guy's name because this a teacher came up to me after the show, and we were talking. And because I'm working, I was doing material that night about how I think the education system is one of the reasons why it's so bad is we're avoiding controversy, and education is inherently controversial, you know. In my opinion. So this guy comes up to me, and he was a teacher at a high school in Indiana, and he was also in charge of the debate club. And the way it worked was, you know, a student would pick a topic and decide whether they were going to debate positive or negative, for or against it, you know. So halfway through the semester, a student came up to him and said that they wanted to debate in favor of the KKK. And he said to me after the show, he said, my first thought was, no, I'm not going to let that happen. So then he asked the kid, he said, why would you want to debate in favor of the Klan? And the kid said, well, I'm in the Klan and my parents are in the Klan. My sister is a member. My grandparents are in the Klan. I think it has a lot of positive things to offer. And I don't think people hear enough about the positive side of the KKK, and I would like to talk about it. So the teacher told me, he said, I went home and I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it, and eventually thought, I didn't put restrictions on these kids. I didn't tell them there are some things that are off limits. So he said, I told the kid, yeah, you can debate for the Klan. And then he picked a student to debate against the Klan. Well, the kid that was for the Klan was destroyed in the debate because you cannot make an intellectual argument for the KKK. It's impossible to do. Genetically, it's impossible. I mean, it would be very hard to go for it. So the kid was humiliated or at least lost the debate, you know. He came up to the teacher after and he said, thank you for letting me do that. And the teacher said, did you enjoy it? Did you learn anything? He said, my God, I'd never heard any of that stuff that she was saying. I'd never heard any of that stuff about the genetics and the makeup and all that and the DNA. And I didn't know, you know. And I thought to myself, where's he going to hear it? He's not going to hear anything negative about the Klan at home. My guess is this kid probably attends a pro-Klan church, you know?
Yeah.
Where's he going to hear this? You know, he has, at some point, people have to be offended to get through to these people. Well, the teacher was fired, you know? Yeah. Parents found out, and, you know, and it upset parents. So complaints started to come in, and the first thing he was removed from the debate club, and then he was let go from the school. So that's my answer, Peggy. I think if any place we should be doing controversial things, controversial ideas. It's in schools.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And I think that the way to handle controversial subjects, just like that teacher did, is to have debate, to have both sides, to have more than two sides.
Yes.
To have discussions. It was an incredible learning experience for all involved.
And there's another aspect of that too. For example, to go back to your example of the KKK debate, when people are not familiar with the pros, somebody could be selling these students these kind of a straw man version of these pros to join the KKK, for example. And if they don't hear these shot down and debated, then they may uncritically accept those ideas. So exactly. you want the pros and the cons to be discussed and talked about, and you want to contrast them with what might be the truth. And the only way to do that really is with good debate, or at least discussion, rather than staying away from the topic altogether.
Yes, the way to handle offensive speech is with more speech.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think critical thinking should be taught in schools. It should be taught early in schools, and kind of give kids a brace to think about things and learn and research. I'm not against the Bible being taught in schools as a myth, that human beings have created myths about an afterlife for forever, and this is one of them. And if you're going to teach it to what the truth is, you know, and teach the whole thing. Don't cherry pick it, you know.
Yeah.
Teach the violent, disgusting behavior that's in it. You know, teach it all. My girlfriend is a Montessori school teacher, and they teach, they have a section during the year where they teach myths, in Native American myths, Christian myths, and they call them myths. Well, they got a lot of flack from the local college. She did a talk to students here at UGA. We live in Athens, Georgia, you know, so it's not a small school, University of Georgia. She talked last year to kids that are majoring in education or wanting to be teachers. And she just offhandedly mentioned the fact that they categorize Christianity as a myth. And, she had several walkouts. People were not happy, you know. Well, that's exactly what it is, you know. So why not just state it for what it is? It's something that we made up as a guess as to what happens in the afterlife.
Yeah.
People don't like their sacred cows being gored.
No, not at all. If they could prove the facts behind the myth, then we'll change the terminology from myth to something else. But until that time, they remain myths.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.